This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When my guest, Dr. David Ansel, was a young doctor in 1978, he started practicing what he describes as third-world patient care. But it was in Chicago, at Cook County Hospital. The hospital's patients were predominantly poor African-Americans, Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, and immigrants. Dr. Ansel says the county hospital he arrived at was ground zero for a crucial question facing U.S. health care. What is the best way to fund and deliver health care to the poor and uninsured? Ansel worked at county from 1978 to 1995. Now he's vice president of clinical affairs and chief medical officer at Rush University Medical Center, a teaching hospital affiliated with the new Cook County Hospital, which opened in 2002. His memoir is called County, Life, Death, and Politics at Chicago's Public Hospital. Dr. David Ansel, welcome to Fresh Air. Hospitals are supposed to be safe, clean places for healing. So let's start with the first time you went to the bathroom, to the men's room at County Hospital. Describe what that was like.
Well, it was 1977, and a group of us came to Cook County Hospital to interview with the legendary chairman of internal medicine, Dr. Quentin Young. Turns out he wasn't there, even though we had scheduled the interview, and we were whisked off to a mass meeting that was being held in another area of the hospital. It was full of people, and people were talking about the hospital going to close and if we didn't do something. But my head was somewhat spinning from that whole morning's events, and I realized I had to find a bathroom. And I made my way to the first floor lobby of the county, asked a guy at a security desk who pointed his way to the bathrooms, which were off to the side of the lobby, and I went in it. And it was so bad, I couldn't use it. And so I ran across the street to, which at that time there was a place called The Greeks, which was a restaurant across the street, and had to use the bathroom there. That was quite an introduction to my first day at county.
So did the men's room that was so unsanitary you couldn't use it, did it represent what the rest of the hospital was like?
Well, it was like no place I had ever seen at the time. You have to remember, it was built in 1914 by an architect who was more interested in creating a monument to Beaux-Arts architecture than to create a patient care institution. In 1927, the American College of Surgeons came on a tour and said it should be torn down and replaced. And this was now 1977. And it was a very old, worn down, tired institution filled with people. And you can imagine, hard to keep it clean, hard to maintain an institution like that.
Since so many public hospitals have closed down in the past few decades, would you just describe what a public hospital is? Because I think a lot of people don't even know anymore.
Public hospitals were created originally in the early 1800s in this country as started as poor houses. The people who lived on the street and couldn't make it on their own had to be placed somewhere. And they went there, and when illness ravaged communities, they transformed into hospitals. And public hospitals in this country have been the last resort for the poor and uninsured, or actually the undesirable of any sort, for many, many years. But at the same time, they've been hampered in many cities and localities by both politics, and they've been part of the larger background of race and poverty in this country.
So if a patient went to a hospital but they didn't have health insurance, were they likely to be sent to Cook County Hospital?
Yes, in the 70s and time before that, it was quite common for a patient to show up at a hospital to be in an ill condition, generally enough to require emergency care, and they would get transferred to Cook County Hospital by ambulance, the reason oftentimes being no insurance. That ended, actually, when after we did a study at Cook County and many others around the country raised an outcry about the idea that very sick people could just be put in an ambulance, and we called it dumping, and dumped to Cook County Hospital. Nowadays, it occurs in somewhat different manner because many hospitals in urban areas have closed, emergency rooms have closed. communities have been somewhat abandoned by the healthcare system. And so now people show up, and they show up in cars, they walk in, they come to the emergency room, and these, again, are the places of last resort in the country. So they're very special in many ways. They're great teaching places, but the dynamic of this sort of vast population in our country that has no access to health care coming to institutions like this is quite tragic on the one hand and uplifting on the other, because where we could provide the best care, we actually provided the best care. But oftentimes we're overwhelmed by what we didn't have the resources to. Not that we couldn't do it, but we didn't have the resources to do all that we could.
Before we get to what Cook County Hospital is like now, you're on the board of the hospital now, let's talk a little bit about what the conditions were like for patients when you started working there in the 70s. You describe overcrowding, beds in the hallways, wards that had been state-of-the-art in the early 1900s, but at this point were just very, well, very what? How would you describe the condition of the wards in Cook County Hospital in the 70s and 80s?
Well, the wards were open wards. And you have to understand, 1978 Chicago, 10 years before, the city was rocked with riots. Much of the west side of Chicago went up in flames when Martin Luther King died. It was described to be one of the most segregated cities in the country. County had become a concentrated institution that took care of poor black Mexican and immigrant people, and in such a manner that they were devalued by the larger society. And the conditions, in some ways, inside the hospital reflected the conditions out in the community. There were open wards. There was, again, an old building. There was no air conditioning. They were cold in the winter. They were very, very hot in the summer. There were screens. The operating room had windows. A friend told me about his third-year rotation on surgery at Cook County Hospital. This is many years after my time there. And he's been taught to scrub and how the proper way to scrub. And he gets gowned in his gloves and walks into the operating room. And the senior resident says, "Your job is to keep the fly away from the incision." There was no privacy. The beds were lined up one after another, separated by curtains, but there was really no privacy. There was one ward we loved as residents. It was called Ward 35. It was the admitting ward. And what was so great about that place is we were all concentrated there on admitting night, all of us young doctors, and the patients would roll in and they'd be lined up around the wall and the walls of this one room. The problem was is you were forced to take histories and examine patients under these conditions, which would have been okay, I suppose, if there weren't the possibility of having shiny new hospitals. So we were across the street from the hospital I work in now, which had single double bedrooms and privacy and dignity. The contrast was what made this so bad. There was a time in hospital history when all hospitals in the United States were like this. But by the time I got there in 1978, and until the new hospital opened in 2002, these were the conditions. And unfortunately, the patients did suffer from the indignity of these conditions.
You described the work that you did at County Hospital as doctors within borders. I think most people know doctors without borders, and these are doctors from around the world who go to war zones and disaster areas and help people who desperately need medical help. And what you're suggesting is that you were doing the same thing, except it was in the middle of Chicago.
Yes. I went into medicine because I wanted to help people, and I went to medical school and found it very disillusioning. And County was a place that many of us went because we believed that disease, even as a young 24, 25-year-old, that disease had social etiologies, and that the idea that disease just emanated from the individual and wasn't somehow constrained or influenced by societal factors, which was kind of the teaching in medical school at the time, that diseases emanate from the individual. So going to a place like Cook County Hospital was a place to go live those beliefs out. And when people nowadays, young medical students or nurses, say they need to want to go to Africa or Dominican Republic, and God bless them for going and doing that, we have great places in this country that need young doctors and nurses to go to, like our public hospitals, where the same problems you're going to see in third world countries are right there, right in our inner cities. We drive past them every day. And that was why I went to county.
You ran the walk-in clinic at the hospital in the 1980s, and you say that this was the most challenging and disturbing job of your career. Why?
Well, if you can imagine a clinic that you open the doors in the morning and people just came in, and they came in all day long from beginning until we closed, and if we kept it open all night, they'd be all night long. The problem with this clinic was the kind of patients we were seeing were people who needed primary care. And they were walking into county hospital to get care that should have been theirs as a right of their humanity in their communities. And it was quite overwhelming to both keep up with the demand, but also keep up with the nature of the diseases that we were seeing there.
You read that the clinic was also known as the screaming clinic because the noise level was so high. And there were periodic eruptions from really angry customers. Were the waits really long? And when people got really angry, did they ever take that out on you as the doctor?
I have to say patients at county were so respectful and patient. And that when they got upset about waiting, it was the kind of upset that no one else would tolerate waiting the hours that they waited. It wouldn't be unusual for someone to come in for a checkup and wait 8, 9, 10 hours, 12 hours for care. So you really can't blame people for getting upset. We try to ameliorate this by putting an appointment system in. But over the years, the numbers of people who've walked in just continues to grow. That clinic is still there. I revisited it many years later. It was as if time had stood still and nothing had changed.
So do you think that the new Cook County Hospital, the one that opened in 2002, still represents the kind of medical apartheid that you describe from when you worked there from 78 to 95?
There have been many, many improvements. New hospitals provided, you know, much more dignified conditions to patients. But if you take a step back and you look at the larger issue of access to care, and I look at healthcare through the lens of being a doctor and the doctor-patient relationship, but actually through a wide-angle lens of being an epidemiologist. And if you look at just healthcare outcomes or things like life expectancy, and you look in Chicago, what bugs me and upsets me every day of the week is the fact that on the south side of Chicago, that a black man dies 8 years earlier than a white man in the United States, that a 16-year-old has a 50% chance of living to the age of 65. And when you look at the reasons for it, at least half of this is heart disease and cancer and things that could be diagnosed and treated if we had adequate health care system and access to health care. So while we have a new hospital, there are clinics, there are still struggles to access the most basic of conditions. I'm not talking about emergency conditions and emergency care. I'm talking about specialty care. Just yesterday, I had a conversation with a physician and said, you know, there's many months wait to see the eye doctor, or there are 4,000 patients waiting to get a colonoscopy. And this is not a screening colonoscopy. This is they've got blood in their stool. And it's what we, again, not what we could deliver under those conditions. So the new hospital and the clinics and the doctors and the nurses are spectacular. It's just if you look at the whole system and you look at the outcomes we're getting and then you look at the sort of the delays that are built in, we're in another hospital in the city you could probably get in the next week.
It's politicians, not doctors, who are working on reforming the healthcare system in one direction or another. Are there things that you feel politicians don't really understand about medical delivery systems?
I think what they don't understand so much is how the payment system drives inequality. And I think that they really don't have great understanding of that. This is a country that, at its best, is built on fairness and equity. You know, if you get a good education, you can make it in this world. You know, if you work hard. But there's a misunderstanding that if you just go to the ER, that that's healthcare. It's not. And I think we've got to think this as in terms of the larger system of care. And I don't think the politicians really understand that. I think this last health reform attempt, which is being bandied about, we don't know what's going to happen, is likely to fall short with regards to equity.
We've been talking about your work at a public hospital. What happens in places where there isn't a public hospital, where the public hospital was closed recently or decades ago? Where do patients go and who pays?
You know, people think we have a safety net system out there, and we do. There are some community health centers in many cities. These are health centers that are somewhat federally funded, where people can go to, but they fall far short of the needs of communities. In the old days, we said we had patient dumping. I think what we have now is community dumping, where large communities around the country, generally in urban areas, but rural areas too, have been abandoned because neither hospitals nor doctors can make it there financially. And the patients in these areas either have to drive far or just when an emergency occurs, get themselves to a hospital. It's less than ideal.
So can I have your brief take on the health reform plan that that passed Congress?
Yes. Winston Churchill once said something like, Americans eventually do the right thing after doing the wrong thing many times over. And this is, maybe a good start, the bad outcome, because we're going to put people into a lot of people into Medicaid, and a lot of people will still be uninsured. And Medicaid system is unfair because people don't have access to specialists. And we're going to end up with disparity persisting for at least a generation. There is better solutions. Medicare for all. Take the Medicare card. Our parents have. I'm soon to be have in a few years. Give it to everybody. Figure out how we pay for it. And manage the costs, and that would be the fairest way to do the healthcare system.
Well, to figure out how we pay for it, I think, is the sticking point for a lot of people.
We are paying for it now. We're paying for it in many different ways, and it's never been an issue of money in this country.
Are there costs that we don't see in the healthcare system now?
Yeah, there's the cost of inefficiency. There's the cost of emergency care. There's the cost of end-stage disease that doesn't have to be. There's the cost of not doing prevention. There are huge costs. We're twice the cost of the next system. And people talk about rationing. We're rationing care every day in this country to poor people. And, you know, 45,000 excess deaths. Chicago is 9 a day. 9 black people die a day in Chicago just because they don't have equal health outcomes to white people. Now, if this was Iraq and a roadside bomb, it'd be front page of the newspaper. And this is occurring in every city and rural area in this country. We're paying for it. It's just we don't add up all the costs.
Well, Dr. Ansel, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. David Ansel is the author of the new memoir, County, Life, Death, and Politics in Chicago's Public Hospital. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Ansel is now Vice President of Clinical Affairs and Chief Medical Officer at Rush University Medical Center, a teaching hospital affiliated with the new Cook County Hospital, which opened in 2002. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What's the opposite of superhero comics? Maybe it's romance comics, illustrated dramas of young love, jealousy, betrayal, and heartbreak that also featured advice about things like how to kiss. The titles give a good sense of what romance comics were like. My Confession, My Desire, My Secret Love, my secret marriage, my intimate affair, high school romance, first romance, love and marriage, love at first sight, love confessions. My guest Michael Barson is the author of the new book Agonizing Love, The Golden Era of Romance Comics. It features covers and excerpts from romance comics of the 1940s and 50s. I asked him to read an excerpt from one of the romance comics, but I realized to really bring it to life, I had to add my own dramatic skills and do the female part. Okay, this one is from Young Romance, and it's from, what's the date of this one?
This is from 1948, Young Romance number 8. A couple is dancing at a party with other couples sitting around. A little old-fashioned record player is spinning. And they each are thinking their private thoughts. So these are thought balloons. And the man's thought is, I wonder what makes Sue so different from the rest of the crowd. Why does everyone call her Wallflower?
And she's thinking, I'm not the most popular girl in town, yet Tommy keeps dating me. Is it because of love or pity? Is that a theme through them? Is it love
or
pity?
Love and pity get mushed together a lot in these, Terry.
So, Michael Barson, why did you start collecting romance comics?
Well, I guess I'm a little atypical in that, these were not really made for 59-year-old men. But I got interested in them in the early 1980s. I'd been a comic collector for at least 15 years already, and already had worked my way through big collections of superhero things and war comics and other manly pursuits. But then I was at a store in New York called Forbidden Planet, and they had just gotten in a big collection of early romance comics from the late 40s and early 50s. I'd never really seen a big bunch of them before, never paid attention. I started looking through them, and I guess you could say I fell in love.
With what?
Well, the stories are little portable soap operas, each one, 7 pages, 8 pages. And they put together an issue or two, and they don't exactly resolve it, but they let it play out as if you're watching a little, I don't know what it would be, a 10-minute TV show or something of that nature. And they're goofy. But there's something, to me at least, irresistible about them. And, of course, they're from a period long ago. But some of the issues and some of the themes really still resound today.
Jealousy is timeless.
Jealousy's timeless. Misery is timeless. I guess pity is timeless.
So would you describe what the basic package was of your typical romance comic?
Sure. The romance issue in general would have 4 or 5 stories, each one a self-contained mini-drama that had a particular problem. Maybe it was a jealousy problem. Maybe it was a faithfulness problem. Maybe it was an insecurity one. But it would be covered in 7 or 8 pages, and then some sort of ending would be resolved, and those characters would be done. You would not meet them again. These were not continuing characters. And you go on to the next story, the next problem. And the filler material would be little quizzes and little vignettes that were semi-advice columns or semi-educational that actually were among the best things in those books. So that in the end, you got quite a bit for your 10 cents out of these early romance comics.
And these romance comics were written for women. They were told, or girls, they were told by from the point of view of young women, but they were created by two men, in fact, who were most famous for creating Captain America. This is Jack Kirby and Joe Simon. And didn't Kirby go on to co-create X-Men and Fantastic Four and Hulk with Stan Lee?
Yes. Years later, in the early 60s, he launched the whole superhero revival with Fantastic Four and even helped draft the first Spider-Man, and then the X-Men, Avengers, and Iron Man, so on and on, all of whom are, to this day, extremely popular and have begat movies every year or two.
So if you think of superheroes and romance comics as opposite ends of the comic book field, how did these two guys, Jack Kirby and Joe Simon, end up creating romance comics?
Well, Joe Simon and Jack Kirby were very canny. They were working out of whatever the popular genres were of the day. One of those was Westerns, and they tried their hand at those, but it didn't really catch on much as a comic book. Boys Ranch was one of those. And the superhero craze of the early 40s had started to die down by the time the war ended. So in 1947, they took a crack at the popular soap operas that were then all over the radio and converted it into a comic book format with young romance, and it was a bonanza. It immediately found an audience and quickly grew to a million issues a month.
Now, one of the regular features of a lot of romance comics was advice columns, and you reprint an advice column that I think is just really interesting and so in a way revealing of its time. And I'd like you to read, this is actually not exactly an advice column, it's a quiz to see, are you ready for marriage, a game of make-believe? But the answers basically give you the advice of how you should behave, because it gives you like three possible answers you should have to each of these questions that are set up, and then it tells you which the right answer is. So it really is an advice column, even though it's a Q&A quiz. So would you read a few frames of this? And I'll try to get the right answer.
Okay. This is from Boy Meets Girl in 1950, and it's called Are You Ready for Marriage? A Game of Make-Believe. And it gives you these illustrated scenarios, as you just described. The first one, when your husband tells you his favorite oft-repeated joke to your guests, do you, A, remark in a stage whisper, there he goes again, and he thinks it's funny. B, lead the laughter after the story has been told. C, interrupt to correct him whenever he isn't telling the story the best way.
That's my favorite, the interrupt and correct him part. But I know that the answer is B, lead the laughter after the story has been told.
in this scenario, the answer is B. I'm not sure my wife would agree with that, but... Nonetheless, it is B. You're right again, Terry.
Always. Do another one.
Okay, this is a cooking scenario. The husband's looking at a plate being brought to him and says to the wife, what on earth is that? And she says, I started making fricassee, but I wasn't quite sure how to do it, so I fried the chicken. I think that's very resourceful of her. But
we have to describe on this plate, is this like... A piece of, like, blackened, steaming, dead-looking chicken.
I mean, yes, it's chicken au poivre, I guess. But this is now, after you slave for 3 hours preparing dinner, your husband says, but this isn't the way my mother fixed chicken. How many times have we heard that? Do you say, A, why don't you go back and eat hers then? I think that's the correct one. B, I spent 3 hours in that hot kitchen fixing this dinner, sob, and you don't even appreciate it. Or C, she's a wonderful cook, dear. The next time I write, I'll ask how she fixes chicken. Right before I shove it down your throat, is what she's thinking. And, of course, the correct answer for that is the last one, because back in this period, 1950, we don't allow our emotions to run away with us.
Okay, let's do one more.
Okay. So one more of these in the same Are You Ready for Marriage quiz. The job your husband has is Greek to you, but when he starts to talk about what happened during the day, A, you listen sympathetically and ask a few intelligent questions. B, you go to the kitchen calling over your shoulder, so you close that big deal. That doesn't get dinner on the table. C, you play it dumb by asking constantly, what do you mean? What's a contract?
So I love the advice we've gotten here is that if in order to be ready for marriage, you have to lead the laughter of your husband's jokes. if you burn dinner, you have to be really super nice about it and say, "I'll get your mother's recipe, dear," and see if you don't understand anything about your husband's work. You have to pretend like you know what he's talking about and ask, quote, intelligent questions, because obviously you're a wife, so you're too stupid to understand what his work is about.
Exactly. These are all Stepford wife answers that you would only get away with being, you know, the polite, subservient wife. But you can tell that the person who put this together was having some fun with what happens in real life, even though he didn't give that as the correct answer.
Yes, because the other answers are probably what you're really thinking.
No doubt.
So these sold really well, right? These love comics.
Well, they were hugely popular from the time that Simon and Kirby started all the way through the 1950s. But once those 1960s got started, they began to peter out a bit. And I don't know why that is exactly. I mean, there was the superhero renaissance that both Marvel and DC had with all of their hundreds of characters, the Justice League of America, the Fantastic Four, all these things, the Hulk, Iron Man, they all got popular all at once. So you could say that squeezed these out perhaps from the marketplace, but it still doesn't really explain why teenage girls, who were the predominant consumers of these, I would think, just basically stopped entirely with them by the time the 60s ended.
Well, there's the whole cultural revolution going on, the women's movement. Clothing completely changed. I mean, the whole premise of these comics, it was just the formula wasn't, not that suffering and jealousy had gone out of style, but the format of the comic had.
Well, but I'll tell you,
of this kind
right,
of comic, yeah,
you're right. Everything had changed, but this is, you know, a form of entertainment, and it changed or tried to change with the times that you're describing. So you began to see hippie girl stories in some of the DC comics of the late 60s and early 70s. And you started to see, you know, peace signs on the covers and, you know, class struggles were really between a boyfriend who was a pot-smoking hippie and, you know, somebody who was wearing a suit to Wall Street or somewhere. So they tried to roll with the changes of the times, but it apparently didn't connect because by the time you hit the middle of the 70s, these were gone for good.
So when romance comics died out, were there new comics that replaced them designed for teenage girls?
There were not. So that's the mystery to me. They were doing something, but everything else they could have been doing also existed when these were at their most popular. So if you say, okay, in 1955, there were a kajillion of these in the newsstands all over America, but there were movies, there were TV shows, there were magazines like 17 Magazine. You know, all these things around the world of romance comics existed then. They still flourished in the 1970s in their own new styles, but these just became extinct like a dinosaur.
Was there ever any implication in a romance comic that somebody was in the closet, that they were secretly gay, but they were trying to get married to cover that up? And they were
tormented
and wrestling with their true nature that they couldn't express.
No, you never got to that point, but that's because these ended when they did as a popular pop culture form. If these had lasted and thrived into the 1980s, let's say, or certainly the 90s, you would have started to see those stories. But at this point, even the religion question was usually cloaked in these. So there was an issue called Different in one of the Simon and Kirby books. And they never really say what the different thing is about the guy. But clearly, it's that he's Jewish. I mean, anybody like me who's Jewish could read the story and say, oh, I mean, yeah, that's what this is. But they don't come right out and say it because It was 1952. So there are these illusions that there's something going on that's creating tension with the families and all this, but you have to read between the lines. So forget the gay stuff. That was something that would have had to come 25 years later, but by then there were no books 25 years later.
So how did you figure out that this guy was Jewish and that that was his secret?
I can't remember. There were a couple little clues. It wasn't like he was, you know, wearing a yarmulke or anything. It was just some subtle little clues that he was you know, an outsider at the school. And, you know, I mean, it could have been something else, too, I guess. But that's the way I took it. Maybe I was reading too much into it myself.
So you collect all kinds of pop culture, including teen exploitation film posters, Red Scare pop culture, these romance comics, superhero comics. I should really be asking this question to your wife, but what's it like to live with you? Like, what kind of what kind of shelves and storage bins dominate your home?
Well, I've been told it's an extremely rewarding experience, Terry.
Yes.
However, I have not been told that by my wife. No, my poor, long-suffering wife, Jean, has exiled most of my stuff, and it is stuff, to the third floor of our house and to the basement, as well she should, because that leaves only two floors to still live in. But I try to keep this sort of under control, but my excuse is that it's too good to get rid of. So it is a source of tension, but I try to be a good boy about it to the capabilities that I am able, which is pretty limited, I must say.
Well, Michael Barson, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Terry.
Michael Barson's new book is called Agonizing Love, The Golden Era of Romance Comics. You can see a slideshow of some of the comics on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews new DVD releases of two very different movies that each involve opera. This is Fresh Air. Opera has played a part in many films, and not only films that are actually about opera. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, is going to review two new DVD releases that involve opera. One is an Italian romantic and political melodrama, and the other is a Hollywood musical comedy. They couldn't be more different from each other, and Lloyd loves them both.
The Italian film director Luchino Visconti was also an opera director, most famously working with Maria Callas in some of her greatest roles. His version of Mozart's Marriage of Figaro was one of the most memorable and realistic opera productions I ever saw. His 1954 film Senso, finally on DVD, actually begins at the Opera House in Venice near the end of the Austrian occupation in the 1860s. It's the climax of Verdi's Il Trovatore. The famous tenor battle cry is here sung directly to the audience with brandished sword and is a cue to protest the occupation.
Di quella pira lo rendo poco.
Italian actress Alida Valli, who's probably best known for her moving performance as Orson Welles' lover in The Third Man, plays an Italian countess sympathetic to the protest. Early in Senso, she says to a smug Austrian officer, played by the late Farley Granger, who's just had a nasty argument with Valli's revolutionary cousin, that she doesn't believe that people's lives should be operatic. But she's about to be overwhelmed by a passion for Granger that will lead her to betray her cousin and all the fighters for an independent and unified Italy. Visconti's mysteriously ambiguous title, Senso, means sense, as in the five senses, or sensation, sensuality, or even common sense. In other words, the Countess's life becomes like an opera. An opera itself becomes a metaphor for all intense human emotion. Visconti's painful and riveting film even ends with a mad scene. Almost the complete opposite of Senso, but even more directly about opera, is a featherweight MGM musical farce from 1946 called Two Sisters from Boston. It, too, is a period piece, taking place early in the 20th century. The late Catherine Grayson plays a young woman desperate to become an opera singer. She leaves her snobbish Boston family and, to pay for her singing lessons, gets a job in a seedy New York nightclub run by Jimmy Durante. Grayson's efforts to break into opera by sneaking on stage during a performance are hilarious. But the real star of the film is the great Danish Wagnerian tenor, Laurits Melchior, who, after he retired from the opera stage, proved to be a delightful comic actor in Hollywood movies. This is his second one, and he plays an opera star upstaged and enraged by Grayson's clumsy onstage intrusions. He has a devoted pet terrier, Tristan, named after one of Melchior's greatest roles. The dog follows him everywhere, even into a recording studio. My favorite scene depicts an early recording session. Melchior is reluctantly recording the prize song from Wagner's Die Meistersinger. He sings into a horn while someone adjusts his volume by pulling him by the lapels closer to or pushing him further away from the horn. When Melchior stops, a bunch of violinists rush forward to play. I think this is Melchior's most magnificent singing on film. Von Blüt und Duft, es fällt die Luft, o la la la, nenn ihr Sonnen, ein Garten lud mich ein, und unter einem Wunderbaum, von Früchten reich behangen, zu schauen im selgen Liebestraum, was ich dem Lob verlangen, Erfüllung hinterhieß, das schönste Weib. Eva im Paradies. The punchline of the scene comes when the recording is played back. When little Tristan jumps onto the table and stares into the horn, someone exclaims, "His master's voice." Everything in the movie suddenly seems a setup for this recreation of the famous RCA Victor logo. I love the way Visconti takes opera seriously, and the way Hollywood doesn't. Together, these two films present something close to the full range of what opera can be.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches English at the University of Massachusetts Boston. He reviewed Visconti's Senso on Criterion and Two Sisters from Boston on demand from Warner Archives. We have some great news to end the show with. Our former producer, Monique Nazareth, has just given birth to Grayson Sebastio Cronin Nazareth. We send our congratulations to Monique and her husband, Patrick Cronin, and wish them all well. I'm Terry Gross.
Baby mine, don't you cry. Baby mine, dry your eyes. Rest your head close to my heart, never to part, baby of mine. Little one, when you play, don't you mind what they say. Let those eyes sparkle and shine, never a tear, baby of mine.